The first line of that song that Peggy played for the offertory a few minutes ago says that life is full of swift transition. And I think most of us probably are old enough and have enough mileage to be able to say a strong amen to that life does send our way lots of transition. And that's what we are talking about beginning last week and continuing today with lesson two. Our Bible study for right now is called Passages, Facing the Challenging Transitions of Life. And I chose passages because passages are would represent the act or the process of moving through, under, over, or past something on the way from one place to another. And that, if you just stop and think about the road that you've traveled, you have had that experience many, many times. And tonight, in lesson two, we are going to deal very specifically with endings. The title for our lesson, if you need a title, when you get the notes, you'll see this next week, is Joseph, Beginning with the Ending. And you'll understand that as we go along this evening. So let's just get started. Let me very quickly lay out for you the definition of terms that we talked about last week. I just read for you the first one, that passages can be defined for our study as the act or process of moving through, under, over, or past something on the way from one place to another. Also, the word transition, as we use it, refers from passage, from one form, one state, one style, one place to another. Now, if you'll remember also last week that we tried to implant within us a clear distinction between two terms that we often get confused and use interchangeably, that would be the word change as it compares to the word transition. Change is what happens to us. Transition is how we adjust to what has happened to us. In just a matter of time, not very long at all, when you look at the full course of our history in Africa, in 104 days, 21 hours, and 12 minutes, Deborah and I are going to retire from Assemblies of God. But who's counting? Deborah and I are going to retire from AGWM. I will no longer have to get up and get dressed and pick up my things and go to 580D West Central Street and sit in an office and do all the things that have been required for the last 36 years. That will be a dynamic change in my routine. Now, the fact of change, not having that routine anymore, that routine will die, and I can formulate a new routine, but that one will be gone. That's change. Transition is how well I'm going to handle the death of that routine, the ending of that routine. That's the difference between change and transition. Now, let's review transitions very briefly. We know that our lives are absolutely full from day one almost until that final great transition with all kinds of significant transitions. Some of them are good and some of them are positive. Not all transitions by any means can be categorized as negative ones, and yet there are others that are not so good. They are in fact quite negative. Some transitions are temporary, while others are more permanent, some of them so permanent that they introduce to us lifelong change. When that transition comes, when that moment comes, that nothing will ever again be the same and life has to find a new normal, that is a serious transition. If you'll recall last week, we gave as a model of that a Johnny Erickson Tada, who at the age of 17 became a quadriplegic by diving into shallow water in the Chesapeake Bay. She is 64 years old today and has transitioned through that traumatic issue of her life to use her very disabilities for the glory of God and for the success of her own life. And she's a prime example of that process of transition. Now, very few people, comparatively speaking, have an accident and become quadriplegics. Some transitions, however, are much more common than that. Some of them are almost inevitable in all of our lives or in the lives of most people. Everybody experiences them. Can you think of one? Did your bones ache this morning? Did they ache more than they did on your last birthday? The aging process is, in fact, a transition. I look back over my life, and it might have just been psychological, but for me, I measure my life by decades. I'll often tell people, I can't do at 60 what I could do at 50. I can't do at 40 what I could do at 30, and I don't even remember being 20. So I've just kind of marked my life by the transition of the aging process. So transitions can also be more gradual. All transitions do not hit you abruptly as some do. Some transitions can be anticipated. They even find us looking forward to them, even preparing for them. Sometimes transitions can't be avoided at all. Other transitions come very suddenly, even brutally, and seem to be unique to that individual or that family. Last Wednesday night, we were dealing with one of those, with the sudden and tragic death of Gerald Borgstad in an automobile accident. That is a transition that nobody expects when they get up in the morning. And suddenly, in just a matter of moments, life will never be the same again for an entire family, for a wife, for children, for grandchildren, for a host of friends. They can be very, very abrupt. Sometimes they're not at all anticipated, and there's nothing we can do to prepare for them. Sometimes they can be avoided. At other times, transitions come, and they just can't be avoided. Some transitions come and go so quickly that they're just kind of a blip on our life story, and we move on. Others, however, could only be categorized as very sharp 45-degree angle turns, or sometimes a complete U-turn. They are so severe in our life. A significant challenge in life, however, surrounds everything that I just said and so much more, and how we react to these transitions, these passages in our lives. It's kind of a normal tendency for us, I observe, to think that the change is the problem. The change going on around us, or the change happening to us, we tend to think that the change is the problem. And that thought can also be accompanied by a sense of blame toward the unknown them, because they are causing the change and they are inflicting the change upon us. Often that change, we see it as against our will, we see it against our choice, and we see it many times in spite of our very vocal objections. And so we have our minds and hearts centered in that the problem is really change. But the truth of the matter is that transition is most frequently the problem. It's not what's going on around us. It's how we are reacting to and handling, even managing, the change that is going on around us. That is frequently the problem. And let's talk about that for just a moment. Humankind, this is my observation, humankind has an unusual capacity for coping with the real world in which we live. Very briefly, in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, right on the border between Congo and Rwanda, there is a volcano whose name I cannot even pronounce. It is so complicated. It is one of the most active volcanoes in the world today. They tell us that the largest subterranean lava pool lies under that volcano and moves toward a methane-saturated lake that is commonly called a poisonous lake because of the methane gas and all the other chemicals in it. It has been said that if the methane could be extracted from that lake, that could light New York City for day after day after day after day with just that methane gas. So not too many years ago, I had just been to Goma and got home, and the volcano erupted. It was a strange eruption. It was a subterranean eruption that flowed well away from the mountain, right to the edge of town, and erupted out of the ground and soon buried one-third of that city up to the second-floor windows of the buildings in that town. The lava flowed toward that lake, and everybody thought when the heat of that lava hits that lake, this could become an inferno. That didn't happen. The lava reached the lake. It began to harden and created several acres, if not square miles, of new land, of hard land. You go back to Goma today, it probably isn't 5 years. It's probably more like 4 years since that happened. You go back to Goma today, and on that lava flow, that new land, right out to the edge of that lake, you will find people having built houses and businesses and shelter on that lava flow. So easily, in a sense, do we cope with the change around us that we think is so very important. I saw a report on television the other day about the millions of people who now inhabit the slopes of Mount Vesuvius, with every scientist in the world talking about the capacity of Vesuvius to blow again. And yet people continue to insist on living in what we would call a dangerous place. Don't even go that far. Go to San Francisco and recall the San Francisco earthquake, and then go see what a metropolitan area it is today, because we have this unusual capacity for coping with the real, the tangible world around us. Where trouble arises is when we think we can just figure out how to cope with the tangible change around us and ignore the fact of what's going on within us that change is causing. Now, you just think of the transitions that we go through. We don't like to think about them. We don't like to think about the loss of loved ones, the death of a spouse, the loss of a child, a traumatic loss of a job and loss of income that threatens our well-being. Like we mentioned last week, identity theft. Somebody using our bank account and our credit cards illicitly. We don't like to think of all of that. A child that gets in trouble and suddenly, instead of seeing Johnny in high school, we're visiting Johnny in jail or in prison. These are transitional issues that really bring trauma to our life. And you know, many times there's nothing we can do. We can't get Johnny out of jail. We can't bring a departed loved one back to us. These are things that we really can't manage, the external part of that change. And yet we tend to try to do so sometime at the expense of what's going on in our heart and mind and our soul. What are the facts of transition? What happens in this issue of transition that becomes important to us? Number one, as I said to you last week, in every transition, something has ended. Something has been lost. We are at a place and a moment of having to let go, to release something or someone in all of these transitions. You may have to think a bit to really identify what the ending that brings you to the process of transition really is. It may not be as flagrant or open or abrupt as the loss of a loved one. It may not be a cancer diagnosis. It may not be the loss of a job. It may be something far more subtle than that, but if you'll think you've lost something and that transition is the result of that loss, There are students that can never be anything other than students. I've had friends that could not cope out of school. They would go to high school. They would graduate from college. It didn't work for them. They couldn't stand losing the routine of study. They couldn't face the new challenges of finding a job and carving something for themselves. They had lost something that they could not regain. And rather than go through the transition process to a new beginning, they'd go back to school and they become professional students all of their life. Something has ended. Something has been lost. We are at a place of having to let go to release something or someone. That's simply because, write it down, every transition begins with a recognizable ending, and that's what we want to talk about tonight. We are going to talk about Joseph, beginning with the ending. Now, let's begin by just taking a few moments to lay a scriptural foundation for looking at Joseph's story in this first step. You can see it on the screen. We're going to read Genesis 37, some excerpts from it, from the English Standard Version. We're going to read, first of all, verses 2 through 4. Joseph, being 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. He was a helper to the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he had made him a long robe with sleeves. Verse 4, 8, and 11. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. Let's see this passage of Scripture again with some highlights there. And notice that you'll see that they hated him. They could not even speak peacefully to him. So they hated him even more, and they were jealous of him. Keep in mind the internal sentiments that are being expressed by these brothers toward their brother Joseph as we go through all of this. For you know, all endings, all transitions, therefore, are not inevitable. Not all endings and transitions are inevitable. Some of them, in fact, are self-inflicted. If you listen to the emotional level running among these brothers and growing all the time, and a level, then you'll see that a level of insight begins to emerge as to what provoked the chain of events that we're talking about. They hated him. They plotted to commit fratricide, to kill their own brother. They could not speak peaceably to him. They hated him even more as time went on, and they were utterly jealous of him in the process. So let's go on and start reading with verse 19. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." Now down to verse 22. And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Now to verse 25. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh, on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood?" Now 27. "Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Now verse 29, when Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone, and I, where shall I go?" Then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in the blood, and they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, "This we have found. Please identify whether it is your son's robe or not." And he identified it and said, "It is my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol or to the grave mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. If you're looking for models and examples of life transitions of every description, you've come to the right place to find them in the book of Genesis and in the life of Joseph. It is absolutely full of multiple parties and their transitions, and many times their multiple transitions. We're going to unpack some of these real briefly tonight, but before we do, let's make sure we're clear about this situation, about this event, this process, this tragedy, this adjustment, this forced situation, this voluntary situation, all of the above, which we can call endings. Every transition begins with an ending. Genesis 37, again, is the beginning of the ending for Joseph and others. William Bridges is the author of several secular books on the subject of transitions. He writes for transitions in industry, transitions in personal life, and other areas. And this graphic design of a simple transition process is one I created based on his model, and it's really very simple. The transition process typically involves three essential steps. First of all, an ending. Call it a loss, call it a cessation, call it a letting go of some sort. Secondly, it is followed by a neutral or a fallow or a dormant period. Now, be careful about that word dormant. If dormant means absence of activity, that's not what this period necessarily is. Sometimes there is significant activity going on in our hearts and lives. It's just not the activity that, it's not the solutions. We're not being given answers. Things aren't being erased that have happened. Bad things aren't being undone. That doesn't mean that things are not going on, but you've got this neutral or fallow or dormant period. And thirdly, then, you have a new beginning that probably should be said is normally based on a new normal. So to fully get the picture, so to speak, let me add that the time continuum here is from left to right as you look at the screen. It starts with the ending, which is backwards the way most of us think. But it starts with the ending, moves through a neutral or fallow season, ultimately to a new beginning. Every transition begins with an ending, proceeds through a neutral zone, and on to a new normal or a new beginning. Now, let's stop right here and listen to me well. lest I give you the wrong impression about all of this. Transitions in life are very seldom, if ever, that simple. There are layers and turns and glitches and stops and starts that nobody can put on a chart. But essentially speaking, if you want to begin to understand the process that we go through, and I really believe that if you'll just think back about people you know, not yourself necessarily first, but others and the transitions you've watched them go through, you can see these periods emerge in the way they handle change and transitions. I can even see this in my own life, and you might can see it too, the way you handle trauma and getting through it. But it's much more complex for most of us. Yet this is the basic process that can help us to begin to understand. If you want to try to understand it, this is really a good way to start. Now, let's take a second to talk about, to take apart this idea of endings. I've been thinking a lot in preparing for this study about how best to define endings for our group that comes together here on Wednesday nights. And I have to tell you, I do very much like the term endings. I like that idea that that's what we're talking about. Transitions are introduced by endings. Something is lost, or something is removed, or something is disrupted, or something disappears, or something is destroyed, or something is replaced. And maybe as you think about a particular transition that you recognize in your life, maybe you could say something is, and add another word to define how you understood that ending, what it really did for you. And it just goes on and on. And yet, in each scenario of an ending that brings us to a moment of almost obligatory new things and different things, in each scenario, we are left facing a recalculation of our lives in one degree or another. How many of you are familiar with the GPS? That little element either on your car dash or in your smartphone that helps you get to where you want to go. Mine is a woman that speaks British. I don't think she's born again, because a born again person could not be as mean and stubborn and agitating as that woman is. Oh, I talk to her. I have to be careful of myself, but I tell her, be quiet, I've got to go to the bathroom. Let me divert. Recalculating. Can't even go to the restroom without recalculating in a British voice. You ever have that happen? You know, can't stop and get a Coke at McDonald's. Recalculating. You know why that word recalculating is there? Because that hard, cold, lifeless machine has defined within it a chosen path. And when I divert from that path, either intentionally or unintentionally, there has to be a recalculation. My mother-in-law is going through a recalculation by taking up residence in a skilled care facility. My wife and her sister and their siblings are going through a recalculation by seeing a parent in that state in life. My grandchildren are going through a terrible recalculation at their young age, having lost their other grandfather just a few days ago. All of these endings, in one degree or another, they bring us into a mode of recalculating. It has to be. It will be. These endings, while they can be subtle to the point that maybe only you know and experience that ending, they can also be very brutal. A subtle ending might be something that nobody really recognizes because they didn't know how important that friendship was to you, and suddenly it is not there anymore. It could be the end of a romantic relationship. It could be the comprehension of a lost opportunity. You just blew it. And nobody else really realizes that, but it is a transitional issue for you. Endings can be brutal. They threaten our physical life, our mental life, our emotional life, our spiritual life, or all of the above at the same time. Endings impacts individuals, couples, families, congregations, neighborhoods, nations, an entire race, ethnic groups. I believe endings even impact generations. The World War II generation has never been the same. The Depression generation, life was never the same. My mother went to the grave collecting bread packages and toilet paper and 5-pound bags of sugar because during the Depression, those things were all short. Her whole mindset changed. That's what endings do to us. Let's look at our story. There's a great deal to be revealed relative to the issue of endings here. First of all, let's look at Jacob. His story is that of the life and the contact and the joy of a special relationship with his son Joseph. And that ended. That favored son disappeared. He was there. His dad sent him on a very long errand. And on that errand, he came to a brutal end. The reality of Jacob's dark ending came to him in three stages, which you can find in verse 33. It's a sad window into the heart and soul of Father Israel, Father Jacob. First of all, he says, "My son's robe, I recognize that." The dawning of reality that something will never be the same again. And secondly, he says, "A fierce animal has devoured him." He held that recognizable robe that he loved to see on his son. And the evidence and the circumstance led him to a panic conclusion. A fierce animal has devoured my son. And thirdly, his mind finally registered the horror of the darkness that was descending upon this parent's heart. And he began to mentally envision the horrors expressed by that coat and the blood and the tears and what he had just said. And he expressed it in his own words, "Joseph, my son, the bearer and the wearer of this garment that I gave him, is out there somewhere without doubt, torn to pieces." Now lift Jacob off of a white page in black ink and make him a man like you. A father like you, a grandfather like you, and try to grip the agony of this man as his great ending occurs. And there is nowhere for him to turn. There is not a way in the world for him to undo it. And keep in mind, you and I know the rest of the story. Jacob did not have that knowledge. In Jacob's experience, just like you, when these things occur in our life, we don't know the rest of the story. We don't know how it's going to turn out. We just know what we're going through. And Jacob only knew what he was going through. He says, "I will go to my grave in mourning." Jacob could envision nothing ahead but a state of brokenhearted ruin for himself. The normal or customary period for a mourning parent was about a week. When Moses died, the people mourned for about a month, and that was considered extraordinary. But Jacob refused any efforts of comfort. The way this reads, could we deduce that old Jacob may have carried a semblance of public mourning during the 2 decades that followed until he finally found out that Joseph indeed was still alive? Let me be clear about something. We'll talk about it more in a later lesson. Mourning, hear me and write it down if you have any questions. Mourning and grieving are normal and they are okay. And successful transition in a situation which produces grief over one thing or another Successful transition is not slapping the back of our own hands and saying, no, 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 shame on you for hurting. No, 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 shame on me for pain. No, 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 shame on me for crying and mourning. No, more so, successful transition in such moment will require and involve grieving. And grieving is not only restricted to dying. There's a lot of things we grieve over. I have grieved over broken relationships. I have grieved over failed plans. I have friends who have grieved over split families. Just remember, according to the Word, we do not grieve like those who have no hope, but you jolly well need to understand that we still do grieve.
Yes.
And there is nothing wrong with it. We'll talk about mourning. Those endings in our lives. They're not all related to the physical. We can and do and should mourn and grieve over other kinds of losses as well. Someone told me a story just this week of a pastor's daughter. Two members of the family were wiped out in a car accident, and this lady took a posture, "I'm the pastor's daughter. I've got to show the world how to face death and dying." And so she was on the mountaintop. She was shouting. She was laughing. She was singing. She was all joy for 6 months and then collapsed in a puddle. It's a mistake not to realize that endings cause us to mourn. And there is an appropriate way to mourn and grieve that which has ended or that which has been lost. Let's look at Joseph. Joseph also had endings. An adolescence, loss of family, an end to the privileged status of a loved one cared for and looked after by a loving father, and now that's all gone. This hurts me. I've seen too many children across Africa who are so separated from the love of a family and the security of a mom and dad and a home and a bed and medical care, and an education. They're at an age where they're supposed to have those things. And instead, we see them by the thousands and the tens of thousands, chased by war and disease and famine and civil unrest. They have none of those things. Imagine, lift Joseph off that white page and make him a stand-up 17-year-old. And imagine the anxiety behind the train of camels being pulled toward Egypt. And he had no idea. Neither did Joseph know the rest of the story. It was all gone. Then it is the ending of trust and plunging into the reality of being betrayed by your own brothers. It was the ending of anything that could be called normalcy, the typical flow of life, and of course, down the drain went anything called security for Joseph, and he moved into a world of the unknown, of risk and fear. But what about his brothers? They too had their endings. By their own choices, they moved into an ending that brought to death innocence by their premeditated plan for fratricide. Their family, by and large, ended on that day. It would never again be the same. Fratricide replaces brotherhood. And then they also experienced an ending of integrity by the deceit they went after with their own father. Don't leave out Reuben. His ending, he tried to save his brother, and it didn't work. Sometimes we do not recognize the trauma of our failed plans. It is like a death when that plan is so real and so positive and so essential, and it's there today, and tomorrow night it's gone. It's like something has died. And you read the testimony of Reuben here, and it's very evident that he loved his brother, and he put family first. He lost his own confidence through a failed mission to save his brother, a lost relationship, a lost brother. And just imagine, pick Reuben up off the page and imagine the war in his mind. If only, how many times did he say, if only, if only, if only? And how many times have you said, if only, as transitions come into our life? Let me give you one final word here. Endings sound so very final. It's designed that way. When we plunge into the depth and the thickness and the darkness of an ending, it does appear that these endings have no way out. There is nothing ever after from that point onward. It's important to remind you one more time. I don't want to leave you here. I don't want to leave you with this word on endings. It's important to remind you one more time. As the final word for tonight, as we talk about endings, that there will be more after your ending. Allow me, I know I've heard it. I've dealt as a pastor with people at the moment of their loss, and you hear the phrases come out of their mouth, I don't want to live. There's no hope. There's nothing left for me. I'll never recover. It's not going to work. I may as well die. Allow me to tell you, you may not see it while you're at the ending. You may not see it in the fallow period, but there will be more. And I want to point you to the word for proof of that. I want to point you to the Psalmist 30, verses 2 through 5. Listen to the Psalmist. Lord, my God, I cried to you for help, and you've healed me. Oh, Lord, you've brought up my soul from Sheol. You restored me to life from among those who go down to the pit. Sing praises to the Lord, O you, his saints, and give thanks to his holy name. For his anger is but for a moment, but his favor is for a lifetime. And then hear this. Weeping may tarry for the night, but joy comes in the morning. You know, if that might not be a bad word for you to write in the palm of your hands, or write inside your coat pocket, or carry in your billfold, or put it in your shirt, or put it in your purse, or put it on the door of your refrigerator, because you will find an ending in your life. We all have them. And at our age, chances are, for most of us, not all of you, but for most of us, they're going to come more frequently. Weeping may tarry for the night, but just rest assured, joy comes in the morning. And then we need to read on a bit to verses 11, 12. You've turned for me my mourning into dancing. There's not a way in the world at the moment of that ending that you can ever dance again. There's not a way that you can ever rejoice again. There's not a way you can ever smile again sometimes on the edge of that ending. But the word says, you have turned for me my mourning into dancing. That's a transition. You've changed. You've transitioned my mourning into dancing. You've loosed my sackcloth and clothed me with gladness. Hear that, Jacob? That my glory may sing your praise and not be silent. O Lord, my God, I will give thanks to you forever. Last Saturday, let me close with a little anecdote. Last Saturday, we were at the graveside. I was really concerned about my two grandchildren. Little Jonas was all curious and asking all kinds of questions, and suddenly, I see him standing up at the edge of the grave. Everybody had stepped back, and here's Jonas standing at the edge of the grave looking down in it. I thought, oh, no. Somebody pull him back. And he was talking to the funeral home gentleman that was there. And I noticed this guy bent down, and he talked to Jonas for quite a while. And Jonas came back over to where me and his father were standing, and Jeremy said, well, Jonas, what did he tell you? And as a little five-year-old boy would do, he said, well, his hands are important. He says, well, he told me that the first thing you do is they put you down in that hole, and then they put a lid on that box, and then they fill it full of dirt, and the next thing that happens is God calls you, and you come out and go to heaven. That's just a little five-year-old boy saying, weeping may endure for the night, but be simple and as innocent as a five-year-old child and recognize that joy does come in the morning. Hallelujah. We may have given tonight to talking about the endings, but we're going to get to sunrise. Just stick with us. Can you receive that tonight? Amen. Let's pray for those in transition as we go, that the Lord will bless them with success in getting through the trauma that these moments bring in our lives.